You know, there's not a single person here who has not personally experienced evil, pain, and suffering. Or if you have not experienced it yourself, there's not a single person here who has not seen someone else experience evil, pain, and suffering. In a sense, we are all in the same boat. To deny the existence of evil, pain, and suffering is even an absurd kind of proposition. Some of us have gone through lots of pain and suffering. Some of us right now are going through pain and suffering. And for those of us who have not personally experienced pain and suffering, you are one day going to experience it. And for such a common experience of life, we all have a response. Every person in this room and in this world has a response to evil and pain and suffering. The question then is, what response do you and I have? Is it a response that aligns with what the Bible teaches about this important subject? You know, we continue our series, Contending for the Faith, as we come to our 10th session in this series. And over the course of the next two sessions, we are going to think about evil, pain, and suffering. Hopefully, you don't think of these sessions itself as painful. But as we work through this topic, my goal is to help us understand and then respond biblically to the issue. I've titled our lesson, Evil and Suffering, part one for tonight. And then when we meet again 2 weeks from now, we will look at part two. So if you want to judge the session, you know, come for both of the sessions and then give me feedback. But we're going to look at understanding the terms, so defining the terms, and then we'll look at understanding what is commonly known as the problem of evil, and then responding to the problem of evil. We'll get to one of the responses today, and then, Lord willing, next week we will look at the rest of the responses while building up a biblical theology of pain and suffering. What does the Bible have to say about these things? But we're not going to go completely dry because we are going to look at an example in the scriptures about someone who went through pain and suffering. So first of all then, defining our terms. If you miss out on writing something, you know, these slides will be online, Lord willing, tomorrow. And a lot of the things that I'm going to say will be on there. So I want you to pay close attention because there's a lot of things that would be said, perhaps you might be hearing for the first time, or for those of you hearing it or have heard it in the past, hopefully this is a revision for us. First of all, we begin by defining the term. What is evil? The Merriam-Webster's dictionary defines evil as something that brings sorrow, discomfort, and calamity. Something that brings sorrow, discomfort, or calamity. In other words, it is the cause of that which is sorrowful and discomforting. It is the reason behind why people face painful or difficult circumstances in life. There are generally two kinds of evil that we know of. One is a moral evil. These are the actions of human beings that are considered morally wrong. For example, murder, rape, physically injuring another person for some sadistic kind of pleasure, taking advantages of the weaker human being is what we can consider as moral evil. But there's another kind of evil, a natural evil. Now, this evil is not directly connected with actions of human beings. Here, I'm thinking of things such as a tsunami, or an earthquake, or a hurricane, or a storm that is not directly connected with actions of human beings. Notice I use the word directly, not directly connected. I use that to convey a biblical understanding of sin and the fallenness of man. You know, natural evil is a result of man's fall or sin, and because it is indirectly connected with sin and fall, we can say that this kind of evil is not directly connected with actions of human beings, but it is connected in some sense because of the fallenness of humanity and sinfulness, sin that came into the world, Genesis chapter 3. That is evil. What is suffering? Well, the Oxford Dictionary defines it as an experience or something that one is subjected to that is bad or unpleasant. Something that one is subjected to that is bad or unpleasant. Pain or suffering is the bearing or undergoing of pain or distress that one faces in life. Suffering is often a result of evil. Not always, but often it is a result of evil. Now, as you can see from the definitions, this is not an experience that takes place in isolation or it happens to only a select few in this world. All of us have or are or will experience this at one point or another. So we need to make sure that we understand what this is in order to be in the best position to respond to it. And that brings us to our second point, which is understanding the problem of evil. What do we mean when we say the problem of evil? There are at least three problems of evil. One, there is the logical problem of evil. Are there good reasons to believe that because evil exists, that God does not exist? Secondly, there is the evidential problem of evil. And thirdly and finally, there is the existential or pastoral problem of evil. Not that the pastor is the problem, but that is the third section that we will look at. The first two are intellectual in nature, and the final one is personal in nature. Before we go into it, let me state this up front. A person who hasn't thought through the intellectual issues is not really in a good position or not fully equipped to deal with the personal and pastoral issues. So it is important and helpful to get our minds around the first two problems of evil, because that will pave the way, that will lay a foundation for all of us to think about pastoral issues. First of all, then we begin with the logical problem of evil. Let me state the premises. There are two. First premise states that God exists and is omnipotent, omniscient, and perfectly good. God, if he exists, he is all-powerful, all-knowledgeable, and perfectly good. Premise two states that there is evil. And conclusion, I don't have it here, but conclusion is because evil exists, and evil and God are incompatible, therefore God does not exist. The problem is that the existence of God and the existence of evil are non-compatible. Let me state the problem another way. Let's assume that there is a perfectly powerful being, and that being can prevent evil. A perfectly powerful being can prevent evil. A perfectly good being will prevent evil as far as he can. If he's powerful and good, he wants to prevent evil. God, as defined by Christian theology, biblically speaking, is perfectly powerful and perfectly good. So if a perfectly powerful and a perfectly good God exists, there will be no evil. But all of us experience evil. There is evil. And therefore, the conclusion from that statement follows that God does not exist. The problem, again, basically stated is this. There is lots of evil in this world. There is pain and there is suffering. If God is truly good and powerful as you Christians say he is, then he should be able to stop evil. Either he is not good or he is not powerful. And if that is the case, then the kind of God you propose, dear Christian, does not exist according to those who oppose it. And that is the problem of evil. It is attributed to a Greek philosopher by the name Epicurus, but was popularized really by the Scottish philosopher by the name David Hume. And this is what he says. He says, is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then is he impotent? Is he able but not willing? Then is he malevolent, which is to say someone having ill intent or evil? Is he both able and willing? Why then is there evil in this world? Now the question is, are these two statements that we stated earlier, that God is good and God is all knowledgeable and that evil exists, are these two statements inconsistent or incompatible? Do they pose a logical problem? Let me just prepare you by saying that for the next 5-10 minutes, are going to be the most challenging for us as we think through these. But once you are on the other side of these 5-10 minutes, you're going to enjoy the rest of the time together. But give me your attention so that we can get through this together. Now, I don't come to you as a teacher who's only interested in unloading information on you, but I come to you as one who's deeply concerned and cares for your soul and wants you to understand this so that as individual followers of Christ, you can benefit from grasping this and grow in your walk with the Lord. Because all of us, remember, either have faced evil, will face evil, or are facing evil even right now. Now, to say that there is a logical problem in this statement or these two premises that I stated, let's say that there is a contradiction. There are essentially three kinds of contradictions that exist. First of all is the explicit contradiction. One statement explicitly denies or contradicts the other. Now, go back to the statement that I made earlier with those two premises. Let me give you an example. If I say to us, it's raining outside, and in the next breath, my next statement to you is, it's not raining outside. That is what is called as explicit contradiction. Either it is raining outside, or it is not raining outside. In the same way, go back to the statement, either there is a good God or evil exists. Are those contradictory in that sense? No, there's nothing contradictory about those two statements. A good God exists and evil exists. I'm not saying a good God exists and a bad God exists. I'm not saying evil exists and evil does not exist. That would be explicit contradiction. And that is not existent in those two premises. There is a second kind of contradiction. It's called formal contradiction. And here is how philosophers define it. If an explicitly inconsistent set can be deduced from the two statements that were made earlier by using laws of logic, then it is considered a formal contradiction. Now, we've already established that there is no explicit contradiction, but can we use laws of logic to conclude that there is some sort of a contradiction in those two statements? Well, let me give you an example, and that might be helpful. There are three statements on the slide. The first statement says, all men are mortal. Aristotle is a man. And third statement, Aristotle is not mortal. Now, something is contradictory here. It doesn't flow. The third statement doesn't flow from the first two statements, right? These all statements cannot be true. And so what we have done is use laws of logic to conclude that that last statement is not actually true. If all men are mortal, and if Aristotle is a man, then what should follow? Aristotle is mortal, right? But so here you can see what is called as a formal contradiction. And thirdly and finally is what philosophers call as implicit contradiction. We can say something is implicitly inconsistent if an explicitly contradictory statement can be deduced by using laws of logic and some necessary truth. Let me repeat that. We can say that something is implicitly contradictory if an explicitly contradictory statement can be derived or deduced from laws of logic in addition to some necessary truth. Let me give you an example. These three statements on the slide, Socrates is older than Aristotle. Aristotle is older than Plato. Plato is older than Socrates. Now, there's something not right in those statements if you read it again. If Socrates is older than Aristotle and Aristotle is older than Plato, then Plato cannot be older than Socrates. There is something that is philosophers call as necessary truth that is being appealed to here. What is that necessary truth? That necessary truth is that you and I agree on what older than means. If I say I'm not, but if I say I'm 60 years old, and you are 59 years old, then that means I'm older than you, correct? And so all of us agree on what older than means. That's what necessary truth means. Now, go back to the two premises that I stated earlier. There is a good and a powerful God, and evil exists. There is nothing explicitly contradictory about those two statements. There is nothing formally contradictory about those two statements. And there is nothing implicitly contradictory about those two statements. Let me add a third statement. An omnipotent, omniscient, and perfectly good being would have no good reason for allowing evil. That is the necessary truth that we are appealing to. Or that is the truth that atheists and agnostics are appealing to. If there is a God, then they are saying, well, then he must not allow evil. They are dictating what he should or should not do. Now, what P3 means, and if P3 is true, then it means that all of the possible reasons that God might have for allowing evil to exist, that none of them are good reasons. That's what P3 means. But the fact of the matter is, none of us can know all of the reasons God might have for allowing evil to exist. And therefore, we cannot know if P3 is true. Because to know if P3 is true, we have to have access to the mind of God. And none of us have that. So in order for them to make good on their claim, they have to know stuff. They have to have knowledge of something that they cannot possibly know. So how do we respond? Well, as a follower of Christ, all we need to do is to show that P3 is false. And how do we do that? If we can find one possible reason God might have for allowing evil in this world, just one reason, then we can show that P1 and P2 are not contradictions, but they are consistent. So how have Christian thinkers and philosophers responded to the contradictions? Well, there have been two responses. One is what is popularly called as theodicy. This is a compound Greek word, compound meaning it's made of two words. Theos, of course, most of us would know, means God. And dikaios means just. God and just. The word together means justification of the ways of God in his dealings with men. And what theodicy is trying to do, it is attempting to provide God's actual reason for allowing evil and suffering. What it is claiming is that we can actually know why God allows evil into this world. Now, we're not going to go here. This topic perhaps needs a separate session in itself. But that's what theodicy believes. It can get to an actual reason of why God has allowed pain or suffering. But we're going to go to the second one, which is really a defense of the view that we hold. This particular defense attempts to provide God's possible reasons for allowing evil. Remember, we don't have access to God's mind. All we have access is to the scriptures, which gives us access, not to in an unlimited way, but to a limited way, to his mind. We can make two statements here. One is we can say that God allowed evil to exist because it would give him the best opportunity to bring about the greater individual good. Let me repeat that. We can make two statements, as I said. One is we can say that God allowed evil to exist or come into this world because it would give him the best opportunity to bring about the greater individual good. By allowing evil, the opportunity for us to be more good or more virtuous is greater than if God did not allow evil to exist. That's what the statement is saying. This is called the soul-making defense, and it was popularized by Irenaeus of Lyon, who lived between 120 to 200 AD. But another response or defense is called as the free will defense. This is attributed to the famous Platonic thinker and Christian theologian Augustine, and in the last 60 years has been greatly popularized by another Christian philosopher by the name Alvin Plantinga. Alvin Plantinga received his PhD in philosophy from Yale in 1958 and taught for many years in Calvin University in Grand Rapids, and then in 1982 he was offered a position in Notre Dame in the philosophy department. And he retired very recently in 2010 to move back to Calvin University. He's still alive. I think he's about 89 years old. And his work actually in this particular area is largely responsible for the logical problem to not be a problem for Christians at all. And so if you're looking for a good book on this, a popular book, then his God and Evil is one famous book that I would recommend for you to read. And here's what you need to hear and understand about this. He states, and I have all of these statements on the slide so that we can look at it and you won't miss anything. Here's how it goes. He says, perhaps God couldn't create a world without moral goodness but no moral evil. He couldn't create a world where there is moral goodness but no moral evil. This is so because moral goodness requires freedom of choice. And to create beings capable of moral goodness, he also had to create beings who were free to choose. There had to be freedom to choose the right. Now, I know a lot of you are dating. Some of you are dating. Some of you are engaged. You know, as you're interacting with each other, if you're dating, for example, and the girl says to the guy, I don't think I'm interested in you after seeing each other for a few days. Doesn't happen here, but I'm just giving an example. If the girl says, I'm not interested in you, what is the most loving thing the guy can do? Continue to push forward? Anyone? It's okay, right? Agree with it. Because the guy truly loves the girl, he's going to give her the freedom of choice. I think that's important to understand. Because if God says he loves you, but you don't have a choice in that, now just stick with me here, and then I'll explain other things that we hold to, but there has to be a freedom to choose in order to be able to be considered moral goodness, right? Freedom to choose the right also is freedom to choose, also entails rather, a freedom to choose evil or the wrong. But some of you are thinking, but isn't he God? Can he not do everything? And to your shock, I have to answer no. Here are some things that God cannot do. God cannot lie. God cannot sin. God cannot change. He's immutable. God cannot allow sinners into heaven. God cannot break his promise. If any one of these is untrue, then we are not worshiping the right God. But all of these are true. I have references there, and they will be on the slides. And so moral goodness requires freedom of choice. And to create beings capable of moral goodness and freedom to choose the right, freedom to choose the right also entails freedom to choose the wrong or evil. And freedom to choose the right, as I said, also entails freedom to choose evil. God chose to create a world where beings capable of choosing either good or evil are there. And in doing that, he allows the possibility of evil. Because you and I, before fall, or our forefather Adam, had a choice. He could choose either good or he could choose evil. And we already know what he chose. What that did was allowed the possibility. So that's the argument for this particular problem. Moral goodness, it goes on to say, can exist really without moral evil. Moral goodness can exist without moral evil. Think about God before Genesis 1:1. Think about what happened before that. There was moral goodness without the existence of moral evil. Think also of what will happen in eternity, where there is no weeping or sorrow, Revelation 21:4. And we will see one day see our Savior face to face, and we will be like him, 1 Corinthians 13:12. And because we will be like him, we will not be able to sin. We all look forward to that day, don't we? Here's how Augustine describes in Latin, which Scottish Puritan Thomas Boston also took and worked on it, and he wrote in his work, Human Nature and Its Fourfold State. Pre-fall, he says, posse picare, and I may not be pronouncing it correctly, and posse non picare, which is able to sin and able not to sin. That was our condition before fall. But what happened at fall? Post-fall, we were able to sin and unable not to sin. Thirdly, he talks about the regenerate man. A regenerate man, or a woman, I'm using that term generally, is able to sin and able to not sin. 1 John 1, if you say that you did not sin, you are a liar, says 1 John in that epistle. And then finally, a glorified man is one who is able not to sin and unable to sin. As we think about these things, it'll be clearer what the issue with the logical problem is. And so hopefully you've grasped what it is that I'm trying to convey here. If not, feel free to go back to the slides, which has a lot of information for us. Secondly, we come then to the second problem, which is the evidential problem of evil. Go back to the two premises that I mentioned earlier. God exists, and he is all-powerful and all-knowledgeable and perfectly good, and there is evil. What the evidential problem of evil is it says that proponents say that because there is so much evil in the world, the probability of God existing is very low. Because there is so much evil in the world, the probability of God existing is very low. Notice they don't say he does not exist, but the probability is low. You can also state this another way. You can say the probability of God existing because evil exists is so low that the belief in God is an irrational proposition. To believe in a God when evil exists is really to be irrational. It's not a reasonable proposition to believe in God, is what they're saying. How do you respond? First of all, I would say, how do you even quantify evil? I mean, is there a measure? And how much evil does it take for God to suddenly go out of existence? How do you quantify evil? Secondly, who decides how much evil is needed for God not to exist? I mean, does the President of the United States decide how much is needed? Or the Pope decides? Or the President of the United Nations decides how much evil is needed? Or a computer sitting somewhere in the deserts of Arizona gets to decide that? Or why does he, she, or it get to decide it? And what qualifies them to decide it? You see, this particular problem of evil actually creates more questions than it provides answers. And therefore, we can dismiss and disregard this second problem. Thirdly, and finally, is the existential or pastoral problem of evil. This gets us closer to the issue. This gets us to the heart of the problem. Here, you're not asking the question, God, why is there evil in this world? Why is there so much pain and suffering in this world? Here, you are asking the question, God, why did you allow that pain and suffering in my life? Or in the life of a dear friend or a relative? This gets closer. This is where the rubber meets the road in another sense. I think of my own situation. I don't mention it to draw attention to myself, but I just mention it as it fits well with this particular problem. So now I've lived in this country for 16 years. We lived in New Jersey and then in North Carolina for 9 years. And then before moving to Dallas, we moved to Dallas in 2015, so 6 years back, so that I could come for seminary and do what I'm doing right now. But since my time here in Dallas, I've been involved in 4 car accidents, one of which ended up in totaling my car. Before that, I had 0 accidents in my entire life. And so as I'm going through the seminary where the budget is already tight, I'm wondering, God, why did this happen in my life? I think of a young couple who were married just for 2 years and were just over the moon when they found out that they were pregnant, only to rush to a clinic within 2 months of finding out that they were pregnant, that they were going in for a miscarriage procedure. I think of a young family with two children, where the dad was working away from home, got into a terrible road accident, and died within 2 months of that accident. And majority of that dad's last month was spent in the ICU. I think of an older couple, Paul and Kathy, with many years of marriage behind them, going after a vacation for a routine checkup with a doctor and finding out that there were some marks on Kathy's body that shouldn't be there. They were asked to do a full body scan, and which they did, and found out that she has stage 4 cancer and she's not expected to survive for too long. How long? Well, the doctors would not tell, but she died within 1 month of that scan being done on her body, right here in Dallas. These are not some unknown people. These are people I personally know. And I'm very sure that each one of us knows someone, or we ourselves have gone through pain and suffering. To such people who are going through pain and suffering, the right answer is not to give them proof of God's existence or to refute the logical or the evidential problem of evil. Because the question here is not whether God exists. The question is, why am I going through what I'm going through right now? And so let me draw our attention to a couple of Psalms before we get to the response. So turn with me to Psalm 6. I'm going to read a few verses from Psalm chapter 6. Notice what the psalmist writes. And someone has put it well: while the entire scriptures speak to us, the psalms speak for us. So many of us who are going through pain and suffering would be able to relate to the psalmist here. O Lord, he says, do not rebuke me in your anger, nor chasten me in your wrath. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I'm pining away. Heal me, O Lord, for my bones are dismayed. My soul is greatly dismayed. But you, O Lord, how long? Return, O Lord, rescue my soul. Save me because of your loving kindness. For there is no mention of you in death. In Sheol, who will give you thanks? I'm weary with my sighing. Every night I make my bed swim. I'm drowning in tears, in other words. I dissolve my couch with my tears. My eye has wasted away with grief. It has become old because of all my adversaries. You know, the scriptures never discourage us from asking questions. But we want to ask it with the right heart attitude. Think of Mary and think of Zacharias in Luke chapter 1 and 2. Mary had the right heart attitude even though she asked the questions. Zacharias did not. And so when you ask questions, which is something that is encouraged as you read Psalms, you're encouraged to ask questions with the right heart attitude. You don't have to turn there, but Psalm 13 says, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart all the day? How long will my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and answer me, O Lord, my God. The psalmist really is speaking for those of us who are going through pain and suffering. And the question he's asking, why? How long, O Lord? That brings us to the third and final section, responding to the problem of evil. I want to begin by looking at some non-biblical responses so that when we come to the biblical responses, the richness and the beauty of those responses will just amaze our hearts and make us bow down in worship to our great God. First of all, some non-biblical responses. Let me think of Hinduism. You know, the first thing you must remember as we think of Hinduism is that there is no one standard text in Hinduism from where they get their theology from. In the Christian faith, we all have the Bible, but there is no such authoritative text in Hinduism. And you will see the impact of that in their thinking, because there are two distinct groups within Hinduism. One says, for example, that evil does not exist. Perhaps you have heard of the word Maya, M-A-Y-A, which in English is translated as illusion. This particular group within Hinduism believes that there is no such a thing as evil. It only seems that way. It is an illusion. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, as we've already established that there is evil in this world. But it is important to remember that they might be saying these things, but they don't live like that. They don't live as if evil does not exist. They can state it, but they don't live it that way. Then there is a second group which says that evil exists. And here, perhaps you may have heard the word karma and reincarnation. This view looks at evil and says, you are suffering, dear person, you're suffering because you have done something in your previous life, you have committed some sin in your previous life, the fruit of which you're bearing in this life. That's karma and reincarnation. So if you are a homeless person, if you're a poor person lying on the side of the road, then you are facing the fruit of your previous life. And when do these multiple lives end? Some have estimated there are 84,000 birth and rebirth cycles that you have to go through to achieve salvation, which they call nirvana. Obviously, this is a fatalistic view of life. In such a view, you cannot do or should not do anything to change your circumstances because that would be interfering with your cycle of salvation. What do you say to an individual who is going through pain and suffering in Hinduism? Basically, you say you must have done something in your past life because of which you're facing the circumstances in this life. So there is no hope for change, and there is no solution in this present life. That is the Hindu view of evil and suffering. Depressing. We come to Islam. Here we do have an authoritative text, the Quran. And basically, Quran teaches that evil originates from the refusal of what they call as Shaitan or Satan, who was one of the angels of God. He was commanded by God to bow down to Adam, and he refused to bow down to Adam. And in his anger, then he was cast down on the earth by Allah. And because he refused to bow down and because he was rejected, he decided that he was now going to take his revenge and would spend entire eternity trying to tempt humans to do evil. If you're interested, that's from Quran, chapter 15, verse 28. That is the origin of evil in Islam. But many Muslims do believe that they have free will, and sometimes evil, they say, comes because of that. But in order not to commit evil, they need to follow, they say, the teachings of Quran. There are five things that they need to do. I'm not going to go into detail, but what is the ultimate response to evil and suffering in Islam? Here it is. Be involved in doing good. Be involved in doing good, doing things that please Allah. In other words, your works become the basis of salvation. They are expected to follow Allah's example of justice, mercy, and forgiveness in their treatment of other people. But you might ask, is there an ultimate solution in Islam for pain and evil and suffering? And the answer is no. There are no ultimate solutions. There is only immediate solutions. That brings us to the third one, atheism and agnosticism. Here too, there is no authoritative text like Quran or the Bible, and there is no one single authority. But based on their famous proponents in the last 100 years, we can actually conclude some things of what their view might be. They say if we are a product of natural events, natural phenomenon, if that is the case, then in the end, we are just chemicals. Richard Dawkins, who is a British scientist, in his book River Out of Eden, A Darwinian View of Life, calls this basic substance that we are made of as DNA. The basic chemical component of human being, he says, is the DNA. Notice what he writes. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. As that unhappy poet A.E. Huseman put it, for nature, heartless, witless, nature will neither care nor know. DNA neither cares nor knows. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. If you're going through pain and suffering, here is what atheistic or agnostic followers would say to you. There is no rhyme or reason. It is what it is. Just get used to it. We are all dancing to our DNA. Well, you take that response and tell that to a father who has just lost a son while he was fighting in Afghanistan. You see, atheism and agnosticism provides no coherent response, and it provides no reason and no hope for someone who is suffering. Are you feeling depressed yet? That brings us to the biblical response. What I want to do in the rest of the 5-6 minutes I have is to walk us through the story of Job. We're going to observe many things as we read and then finally draw one key lesson from his life. And when we meet, Lord willing, next time, we're going to spend all of our time considering the biblical response to evil and suffering. Things like, what does the Bible have to say about pain and sickness and how to best understand and respond to it? So turn with me to the book of Job as we walk through the story of Job. In terms of timeline, most scholars agree that this must have taken place sometime during the book of Genesis, or maybe even prior, apart from chapter 1 and 2 and 3. And here is Job's story. The story begins, and we're just going to read through it. Chapter 1, verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Here is a good man. Here is a righteous man. The writer of Job, or the author of Job, is taking pains to help us understand that this person is a righteous person. Goes on to list his possessions. At the end of verse 3, it says, and that man was the greatest of all the men of the east. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day. And they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When the days of feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did continually. Job is a righteous man. Job is a blameless and an upright man, one who fears God. This Job did continually. But notice, secondly, the trials of Job, chapter 1, verse 13. Of course, between these two sections is that account of when Satan visits God, and God actually initiates letting Satan know that whether he has considered his servant Job. And then that brings us to verse 13. After God allows Satan to take hold of Job, so to speak, verse 13 says, now on the day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. On and on and on till all of his children are dead. Notice verse 20. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head. A natural response to a difficult circumstance is mourning in this case. He fell to the ground and worshipped. He said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Through all this, the text reminds us Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Job is a righteous man. Job is a righteous man. Chapter 1, chapter 2 actually takes pains to remind us of the fact that Job is an upright and a righteous man. Again, another incident takes place in God's presence where Satan seeks God's permission, really. And God says to him, you know, Satan really says to him, you know, is he worshiping you? Is he not worshiping you because he has everything? I mean, touch his body and then see how he responds. And God says, okay, you can touch him physically speaking, but only spare his life. Verse 6. Verse 7, then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Again, reminding us of the fact that he did not blame God and did not sin. We'll come to why that is the case. Let's get to the well-wishers of Job. First of all, his wife. Now remember, his wife is also the one who has lost the children. We tend to forget that because of the title of the book. Notice what she says to Job in verse 9. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." Now, we can come down heavily on the wife here, but actually she is proposing a certain philosophy of looking at pain and suffering, and the philosophy is this: you are suffering because you've done something sinful. And so why suffer anymore? Just curse God. At least that will take care that of the fact that you will die sooner rather than suffering in this way. And then his three friends come. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Notice verse 11. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon them, they came each one from his own place. Verse 12. When they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept. And each of them tore his robe and they threw dust over their heads toward the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was great. This is probably the best response in the entire book of Job that one could give to someone who is suffering. Just be quiet. Wise response in most circumstances. Many of us are tempted to say something, but really you being present there is such a comforting thing for those who are suffering. We don't have to read the entire 30-odd chapters here, but Eliphaz's view of sin was, Job, if you sin, you suffer. Bildad's view was, Job, you must be sinning. That's why you are suffering. And that was a similar view of Zophar. You are sinning, Job. That's why you're suffering. The closest amongst those friends of Job was his younger friend, Elihu, who is introduced much later in the book. And his view is God purifies and teaches the righteous through suffering. That's why you're suffering. But that's also not an entire biblical view of pain and suffering. That brings us to the fourth and final section, the God of Job. You know, Job cries out to God. We see that in Job chapter 30, verse 20 to 31. I cry to you for help, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you only look at me. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. Job cries out to the only one who he knows can help him. But Job also has a dilemma. And in Job chapter 31, verse 35 and 40, Job knows, for example, that he has not done anything to immediately deserve the suffering that he is going through. But he is still going through suffering. But not only that, Job chapter 31, those few verses remind us that there is a providential God who is still on the throne. If God is providential and I have not done anything, why am I still suffering? Finally, God responds to Job. Verse 1 of chapter 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man, Job. I will question you and you make it known to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding." God's response to Job is not a series or lists of answers, but rather a series of more than 70 questions that are put before Job. Job, where were you when I was laying the foundations of the earth? If you cannot understand and answer that question, then how are you going to understand the immediate suffering that you're going through? That is the point, isn't it? Job, I'm not going to give you a reason of why you are suffering. Instead, what I offer to you, Job, is a relationship. Go down to chapter 40 and notice Job's response. rather 42. After all the 70 plus questions that touched upon geology and all the other fields of science that are out there, Job answers the Lord and says, I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have declared that which I do not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Lord, I cannot answer you because I was not there. If I cannot answer you, that means I cannot even understand why I'm going through what I'm going through. And God's response, really, if you read these last five chapters, is this. Job, trust me. Have faith in me. Believe in me. Because if you know who I am, you will be able to understand that everything that you are going through, I'm in full control. That is something that reminds us of Joseph and his statement to his brothers. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Romans 8:28 says, and we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. The only way we are going to respond to suffering in our own life is to display full and complete trust in God. Trust me. Let me give you a personal illustration, not true, but just a hypothetical one to help you understand what the point of this story is. Imagine I'm driving on the road on I-114 in late in the night as I'm coming home from Frisco. We live in Bedford, by the way. And so I'm going that side. And in my rear view mirror, I see a car that is behind me, like about 100, 200 meters behind me. And I'm seeing this driver go all over the lanes. He's not sticking to one lane. And it's getting closer and closer to my car. Now I'm getting to the side and trying to let this erratic driver pass me by. And as I see this driver pass me by, I am actually stunned to see that I not only know the car, but I also know the driver who is inside the car. The driver happens to be my father. And now I'm thinking, I'm worried for what will happen if this car continues to go in that direction. But because I know the driver, I know that there must be some good reason for why he is driving the way he is. Perhaps he wants to get to a particular location faster. Perhaps there's an emergency. Do you see what happens when you know the person? That's what God is saying to Job. Job, trust me in the midst of this. If you don't know answers to the simplest, according to me, the simplest questions that are out there, how can you even begin to understand why you are suffering? And so the largest or the biggest response that we can give to our Heavenly Father is to show and display our trust in him. And Lord willing, when we meet again next time, we will look at some of the more particular things and look at some of the very practical things and responses to pain and suffering. I can only conclude our time by quoting what Paul quoted at the end of chapter 11. As there, even to the reader of Romans, he's trying to help them understand that you need to trust God. Regardless of whatever is happening in your life, you need to trust God because we are dealing with a God who is trustworthy. And here's what he says. He says, oh, the depths of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor, or who has given a gift to him that he might be repaid? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Let me close our time in a word of prayer as we get into our small groups. Father, truly you are the only one who is worthy of our praise and adoration and worship. You alone are trustworthy. You never sin, you never lie, you never break your promises, you never change. And for your children, that is the most comforting truth to know. That you're a God who is trustworthy. We can lean completely on you. Lord, I do pray for our small group time that it would be personally edifying and that it would be glorifying to you. We commit the rest of the evening into your hands. In Jesus' name, I pray. Amen.